Okay, so I think we're good to go. I think we'll have question time at the end, as usual, the last 10 minutes or so. But we'll start off, see if Chris's system is really working, and he has an update from a topic he had last week.
Yes, fortunate and unfortunate, I guess. Good that it's an update. But at our last Q&A, there was somebody on the call, I forget who it was, was trying to copy a 6 gigabyte file to a flash drive, and it was erroring out. And I said, oh, just make sure it's formatted FAT32 or NTFS. But normally on flash drive devices that size, you probably just want to do it FAT32. And I said that they support individual files of over 4 gigabytes. And after the call, Steve wrote to me and said, why did you say that? Because as far as he knew, the FAT32 didn't support over 4 gigabyte files, and that's true. So I was wrong. FAT32 only supports file sizes up to 4 gigabytes, so you're never going to get a 6 gigabyte file copied to a flash drive if it's formatted FAT32. So what you can do is format it as either XFAT or NTFS, and those will support file sizes up to 16 exabytes. So I hope nobody has any problems with a limit of 16 exabytes. So if you want to do the formatting of a flash drive, in File Explorer, if you right-click on the flash drive, you can choose Format, and then there'll be an option for File System, and you do the drop-down, and you can choose NTFS or XFAT. And if you're doing this, make sure you select the right drive. You don't want to select your C drive or your backup drive or something like that. So just make sure you do right-click on the correct drive, and that's it. So my apologies.
Tom wants to know, what if your file is 17 exabytes?
You can do with it as you wish. If you have a 16 exabyte drive, I don't know anybody who has a 16 exabyte drive, so I don't think that'll be a problem.
And okay, the next topic is yours too. Okay.
Yes, the next one is mine as well. So this is another one that we talked about at Q&A, and that was the idea of Android device. When you plug it in to a computer, it actually defaults to charging mode. And most of the time, if you're plugging it into a computer, you actually want to do transferring of files. And so the preferred option would actually be to have it as a file transfer as opposed to charging. And I've lost my Zoom. Oh, there we go. Okay. I lost my controls over the slides. So just going back over what we talked about last time, where Alan provided the solution for that, to do the default mode for USB on Pixel. And this one, I just did the instructions for Pixel 6, which is what I have. So you go to Settings, About Phone, you scroll to the build number, you tap it 7 times really quickly, and you'll see a message saying you're now a developer. And then you can go to Settings, System Developer Options, and you go down to Networking, Default USB Configuration, and you can choose File Transfer or Android Auto. And they say that sometimes that'll actually be listed as being File Transfer MTP. So whatever comes up for you, go for it. And then that worked. So I plugged in the Pixel 6 computer into the computer, and immediately the computer saw it as a device, and I could then go into this PC, see my Pixel 6, and I could go double-click on it, and I could transfer files one way or the other. So I thought, well, normally I want to charge my phone using a charger, but what if I plug it into a computer because it's the only charging device that I actually have? I don't want to have to go back through that whole rigmarole to change it back into charging mode. And so what do I do in that sort of case? So it turns out there's no need for that. So if I plug a phone into the computer and I pull down from the top of the screen and I get the notifications, and I can see that it is now defaulting to file transfer because I did make that change in the system options. And so I could tap USB file transfer, and I could change that to no data transfer, which presumably would switch it back to charging mode only. But is that even necessary? Because when I'm in file transfer mode, you can see at the top of the screen, my phone is actually charging, And I use a GSAM battery monitor, and it actually says that my phone is charging. So even though I was in data mode, it turns out that I'm charging as well. And so I went back to Perplexity, and I said, when I'm in file transfer mode, the phone still charges at the same time, and is that something that should be expected? And sure enough, it says, yeah, that's what you should have. So even though you're in file transfer mode, it'll still charge at the same time. And they say file transfer is not power off mode, and it allows the connected device to access the storage. It does not disable the charging. And what you should expect when you plug in PC and file transfer mode, it shows as a storage device on the PC, and it is charging at the same time. So, and when you're plugged into a wall charger, of course, it just does charging. Can't do data transfer on that.
So Tom just jumped in with his hand up. Maybe that's relevant to that slide.
Okay. Tom? You're muted.
Just one thing. If you have it always set to data transfer, and you then plug it into something as at the airport or at a concert venue or something like that, you're then subject to your phone being altered by a malicious program that might be in there. So if you're going on a trip or going anywhere where you're going to charge your phone from a USB port, then you need to change it back to charge only before you go.
Well, personally, what I would do is have a cable that has the data lines disabled, and so it will only charge when you're going to be plugging it into unknown locations like that. They're easily available at places like Amazon. If you just look up USB charge-only cable, you'll find them there, and you'd be much safer off just using that, and then you don't have to worry about whether you're in charging mode or data transfer mode. So to my thinking is the best configuration is to use the developer mode the one time only, change the default mode for USB to file transfer. If you plug it into a computer, you automatically get file transfer mode, and it charges while you're plugged into the computer or when you're plugged into the charger. So to me, that's the best configuration. So that's what I've got my phone set to, and that's what I intend to leave my phone set to.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Next up, we have a share. I'm going to let Stuart tell us about this one because it's from him.
Well, I'll try to explain it, but this is a bit of a weird one for me. It's almost like the guy that wrote the article I'm referencing here is a grudge against Samsung. But what the heck, a lot of people do. So, you know, let's go with it. There's an article referenced in this slide about, on notebookcheck.net, which is the European website I like, because I like those European sites in the morning. They've already got articles written while everybody else is still waking up. And apparently a couple of researchers took Samsung's internet browser apart to see what sort of how updated it was for security purposes. And it was about 6 months out of date of the latest Chromium update. So the article goes on and on and on and on. But essentially what it comes down to is, if you don't work for Samsung, you're never going to know exactly how updated the Android Samsung internet browser is. It's particularly bad with what they call a patch gap, and that is the time between when a vulnerability is discovered and when it gets fixed. And of course, Google is the one that usually fixes these things, and they slap it in their Chrome web browser as quickly as possible. But Samsung takes its own sweet time about it, apparently. So the bottom line, as I said, is that if you don't work for Samsung, you've got no way of verifying how secure or up-to-date your the internet browser on your mobile device is. So you shouldn't trust it. That's all I can say. I mean, if you want to use it for looking at cat videos or mundane stuff like that, or you have to use it for some particular reason, go for it. But don't go shopping with it. Don't do any government stuff. Don't do any financials. Anything that you really care about being secure, you shouldn't do it with Samsung's internet browser. Sorry, if you like Samsung, but I suggest you read the article linked in the slide here or in the chat and check it out for yourself. It goes on and on and on, and it's ugly, but don't trust Samsung. I never did myself, but what the heck. It's a nice browser, but if it's not secure, it's not secure. And that's about all my throat's going to let me say tonight, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Stuart.
Okay.
Okay. Next up, by coding competition. But it's September now, so we're starting up our monthly meeting. So as you'll find out later, next week will be our first regular monthly meeting of the season. And the second one in the series will be on October the 14th, and that's going to be our Vibe Coding competition. So if you're thinking about putting in an entry, then you have a limited time frame right now to do your Vibe Coding. And just to remind you that Vibe Code, the rules of the competition are few and far between. And Vibe Coding is going to be on the honor system, so we're expecting you to chat to your browser and let it develop the code rather than you write it from scratch. So it's supposed to be a Vibe Coding developed solution. And there's going to be two different categories of prizes. One will be for the most useful end product, and that can be anything, a website, a script, a program, a macro, or whatever. Anything that's been developed using the Vibe Coding technique that people think is the most useful of the bunch that have been presented. And then the second option is going to be for the actual best presentation of how this application, whatever it was, has been developed. And the note there says it doesn't have to be a successful development. Real failures will be of interest if they're told in a humorous manner, I guess. Anyway, the best product, the best program, and the best presentation are our two categories. Now, I mentioned that the competition is going to be held on October the 14th. And right now I have three people who've indicated they're going to make presentations. And clearly the time for each presentation has to be limited by the number of entries. And so because people who are going to make presentations are going to need time to organize their slides to fit the time that's going to be available to them, we have to establish some kind of deadline. So what I decided is that the deadline for new entries is going to be September the 30th. So if you want to enter this competition, you have to tell me that you're going to have an entry by the end of this month. And just send some brief details. You don't have to send me the whole thing. Just send me some brief details, and you can send that to suggestion box, or you can send it to my email address, whatever you wish. But that's the deadline, September the 30th, for indications that people are going to enter this competition.
Is there a limit to how many entries you can make?
No. Well, no, unless I get 70,000 entries and then I'm going to have to have a lottery or something. But, you know, I mean, if it's three or four or six, I don't really care. It'll just limit the number of minutes per presentation, basically.
Will there be a time?
There should be a reason why I don't think you should be entering 12 entries or something.
Will there be a time limit for each presentation?
Well, yeah, because we only have an hour and a half for the whole session.
So not pre-announced?
No, each person will get limited to a certain number of minutes for all of their presentations, and that will be determined closer to the actual competition.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it. If you want to have two entries, you're probably going to have to have the same time to present both entries at the same time. That would be fair, I think. Okay, now let's just go back and think about, if you haven't been following this magic series of mine on vibe coding, and it's basically a way to let people who don't know anything about programming, you don't know a programming language, for example, but you can create programs, some kind of application, and it can be an HTML website, it can be an Excel macro, it can be a bash script, it can be an executable program for Windows or Linux or the Mac or whatever. Could be just about anything that needs computer code. And you may have to download any tools that you require. If you're going to write a Python script, for example, or a C program, then you need to have the interpreter, the Python interpreter, or the C compiler to deal with the code. But once you've got the tools available, then what you do is you use a chatbot. And you can use just about any chatbot, as far as I can tell. And you basically tell the chatbot what it is that you want the app to do. And it will produce some code for you. And then you run that code and see what happens. And if it doesn't work as you wish it to, then you go back to the chatbot and you say, well, I want you to do this rather than this. Or if it pops up an error, you just give it the error. Hey, this produced an error. Please fix it for me. And you go around this loop of prompting the chatbot and running the code until the code does exactly what you want to do. And if you've been following my series, you'll know that it usually takes a number of tries to get there. And sometimes the chatbot gets off on a tangent, and you have to be really patient, but you also have to be persistent and force it to do exactly what you want. Now, I have a really a simple example, and this time it's an Excel macro. And if anybody uses Microsoft Excel, you probably know that the macro language is Visual Basic for Applications, so-called VBA. And so I'm going to tell the chatbot that I want to create an Excel macro. And the situation is we've got a spreadsheet, and it's recording purchases of GICs. But it's recording these for two different people. And his GICs and her GICs are lodged in registered retirement income fund accounts. So they're separate accounts, one for each person. There's also a joint account which contains GICs, and that's a third account which is a joint bank account, basically a joint investment account of some kind. Now, the thing is that CDIC, the Deposit Insurance Corporation, provides up to $100,000 coverage on each of the accounts. So he has a $100,000 coverage, and she has $100,000 coverage for the RIP accounts, and they also jointly have $100,000 coverage for the investment account. Now, let's suppose that they have some more money to invest. What we want to do is invest it so that they don't blow that $100,000 coverage on the joint account. We're going to assume this is investment type accounts. So here's our spreadsheet. And it's limited to one page. It's pretty simple. The numbers are straightforward. And you can see that he and she have accounts with different banks, different banking organizations, and different amounts and institutions for the joint accounts also. And this spreadsheet is basically broken down by maturity dates. So it tells them when the GIC was purchased, when it matures, what the principal was, and how much interest they're going to make, and that kind of stuff. So what they want to do is they've got some more money, and they want to invest it in this joint account, but put it somewhere where they will retain the $100,000 coverage. So we're going to use a chatbot, and this time I've chosen to use Claude. And Claude says, "Good afternoon, Alan." And then I told it, "Please write a VBA macro that creates a worksheet named GIC's current, or clears that worksheet if it already exists. And basically copy row 4, which is the header, from the GIC's worksheet to the current, to this GIC's current worksheet." So it copies the header over, and then it's going to go through each row, and if the day, if the maturity date, if the maturity date is greater than today's date, so in other words, if it's already matured, I don't care about it. I don't want to worry about it. But if it's still pending, then I want you to copy that over to the other spreadsheet. So it cycles through that existing spreadsheet, copies all the relevant rows of data over there, and then I want it to switch control to this new worksheet, and then I want it to sort the data by columns B, C, and E, and you'll see in a second, that's basically the owner and the institution and that kind of stuff. And then finally say, processing is complete. So once I hit the magic arrow here, go do it, then it comes back and it tells me, here's the VBA macro that does what you described. So here's a little copy the code button. So we just click on that, store it to an Excel macro, and we can run it and see what happens. Interesting enough, I didn't really give Claude enough information. So it's made a bunch of assumptions here. So I told it, I think row 4 was the header. So it's assuming that row 5 is the start of the data. Sounds kind of reasonable. It's used A1 to Z as the sort range. Now that's basically a whole pile of columns which we don't really need. And it says I can modify that if I want. Today's date, it's going to use the date function with no time component. That's fine. I just want the year, month, and day. That's all I need for that. And it's going to put the worksheet, the new worksheet, at the end of the worksheets that are in the spreadsheet file. So all those assumptions are actually good. We can let it run. So we'll run the code, and this is the output. And here you can see here that here's the original GIC's worksheet. Here's the one that it's created called GIC's current, i.e. the ones that are yet to mature. And it told me that the processing is complete, and you can see it's sorted them by owner and by the institution, and although you can't see the data maturity. So a couple of things there. If you look carefully at that data, it would be nice if we expanded these columns so that we'd actually read everything. The reason that these things are all blanked out with these number signs, the field isn't wide enough, so it can't tell me that this is the 17th of September 2027, for example. So I need to make those columns wider. And the other thing I thought it would be nice is, once it changes from hers to his, it would be nice to have a blank line and highlight that in yellow, so I can split up the different categories more easily. So I told it, modify the macro to auto-fit the column width for B to I, so from the owner to the maturing number here. And then starting at row 2, when the value in column B changes, so when hers changes to his, add a blank line and highlight columns B to I, the whole line in other words, in yellow, and continue to the end of the worksheet. So that's my second prompt to make the macro run a bit more like the way I'd like it to. So bingo, we do that, and now you can see that it's kind of sorted that messy spreadsheet out. So we've got here's her stuff, here's his stuff, and here's all the joint things that we want to look at. And you can see that they're all invested in Tangerine. They add up to 100 grand. So we definitely don't want to put any more money in Tangerine, but we can put it just about anywhere else. So that's my kind of simple macro to sort that kind of task out. And if you do any VBA programming, this is the code that Claude generated. You see it's created a subroutine called create GIC's current, set up a bunch of variables, and then a whole bunch of code to do various things. Now, I also took a look at producing this for LibreOffice Calc. And Calc uses LibreOffice Basic, which is a bit like VBA, but it has different syntax. And sometimes it's a bit weird, I think. And sometimes it uses these things like dispatchers, and it calls up a service, and it has kind of a reverse URL to run some kind of helper type routine. And I found that some of the chatbots have problems when they're developing LibreOffice Basic code. So it really does take me quite a few times generally to get it to create the working code that I actually want. And this was a case in point. It turned out there were a couple of instances where it was easier to actually tell the bot specifically what to do, how to program the code, rather than let it make its mind up. So, for example, it had some code where it was trying to set the optimal width for those columns in the new spreadsheet. And it kept giving me new code, but it never optimized the widths. It didn't work. So I said, rather than do that, can you just modify the macro and copy the original columns from the GIC spreadsheet to the new GIC's current spreadsheet, and then you wouldn't have to bother trying to reset the widths? And it says, yes, that would work really well. It's absolutely the right solution. Well, I don't know why it didn't think of that. Anyway, it did that, and that worked really well. Another thing that happened was, when I looked at the spreadsheet that it had generated, all the yellow highlighted rows were down the bottom of the table. So clearly what it was doing was doing the sort after it was applying the yellow highlighted lines and then doing the sort, and all the blank yellow lines basically fell to the bottom. So I told it, modify it so that the lines are added after you do the sort, so which is basically what I thought it should have done. And that's what the Excel macro did. It did the sort and then added the lines afterwards. And again, that's a smart change, and it makes it cleaner. It actually made the code easier and shorter, basically. So that worked quite well, too. But there's a couple of examples where sometimes it's easier to tell the thing how to program it rather than let it try and decide and keep getting it wrong. Anyway, the point is, the vibe coding thing is pretty simple. If you have a specific task, and it can be automated using a script or a macro or a program, then you can basically just tell the chatbot what you want it to do and let it decide how to do it. So the question is, do you have a task that can be automated, that something that you do repetitively, it's kind of boring, so why wouldn't you create a script or something like that to do it for you? And if you do that, then you would have an entry for our vibe coding competition. And as I say, you've still got lots of time. You've got several weeks to generate it. But I'd like to have the entries by September the 30th. So there you go. Vibe coding competition coming up in October. And I'd be really interested to see everybody's entries. And that's all I have, Chris. Anything we should be in the chat?
I don't see anything in the chat other than Tom said Claude is good for coding. And there was a question about, or a comment from Elizabeth saying, too bad the chatbot doesn't get the tools needed for the task. And I said, well, you can probably, you know, tell it I need to know how to install the tools, and it will certainly tell you where you can go to download them and so forth, or you could use something that is already installed on your computer, like PowerShell. So if you use PowerShell, it's already installed in Windows, so it'll just give you the code, and it'll tell you how to run it within PowerShell. And so you could use that. Same with shell scripting. If you just use simple CMD file, you know, some of it you don't need additional tools to actually do.
And if you're using Linux, then Python's already pre-installed, so that's no problem either.
Yeah, and as Alan pointed out here, you know, you wrote VBA script. Well, VBA is built into Excel, so all you had to do is paste the code into an Excel workbook and then run it.
Yeah, it's pretty simple stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, next up is yours, Chris.
Okay, so which 2FA to choose? So this was an email that came in to suggestion box, and the person said they were changing the security settings for an email address when they were, I believe it was their bank, they were setting up two-factor authentication. And it was given an option for two-factor authentication to use either another email address or a phone number. And so the question was, is one better than the other, other than convenience? And I think, yeah, that's a pretty simple thing to answer. Well, maybe, maybe not. Pretty simple to for me to just say what I would recommend, but I think that this actually deserves a deep dive. So two-factor authentication is something that can be a little bit confusing, and so it's good to have a good understanding of it because it's becoming more and more required. So when you're talking about the different factors that can be used for authentication, they're typically talking about three. So the first is something you know, and that will usually be your username and your password. So we've known those for the longest time. And then there'll be something you have, so either a smartphone or another email address where the website can interact with you to make sure they think that it really is you. And then the third one is something you are, and that is usually a fingerprint or a facial scan. There's also the ability to, within some things like Windows Hello, there's actually the code there that would allow iris scanning. But I don't know any iris scanners out there that can take advantage of that. So almost always when it's something you are, it'll be either a fingerprint or a facial scan. And so two-factor authentication, as it implies, requires at least two of the above. And most commonly you'll find it'll be using something you know and something that you have. So the common implementations for something you have, so it could be a one-time code sent to a phone as a text message, so that you have, you first put in your username and password, and then you, that something you have is your phone where it'll receive that text message. Or it could be a one-time code read out to you over the phone. And if you only have a landline, that might be a good option. One-time code sent to an email address. So it'll send you that. You have to go to your email, pick up the message, and then you get that code that you can put in to complete the authentication. Or one-time code sent to an authentication app that you have installed on your phone. You can also have negotiation through a passkey application or implementation. You can have negotiation with a smart card or a FIDO security fob. I'm not going to cover that because it's pretty rare. It's very strong authentication, but it's not commonly available on websites where you can actually tell it that you want to have your second factor of authentication, a smart card or a FIDO security fob. So I'm not going to really cover that off. Anybody who is using one of those is probably already madly typing away how I'm an idiot in the chat, and that's probably true. Another one that is actually really rare is a challenge to input values on a bingo card. And the reason why I put it here, even though it's really rare, is that it is available with Canada Revenue Agency. Since we all deal with CRA for our taxes every year, then that's one option that you might want to consider. And I'll talk about each of these.
Chris, just before you go ahead, Alice has got her hand up. So.
Okay, sure. Alice.
Need to unmute your mic, Alice.
Sorry, that was a mistake.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
We'll carry on. If we look back and say, if you don't have two-factor authentication at all, you're just using something you know, Okay, so this is typically your username and your password. And it's hard to actually successfully compromise that as long as you use a very strong password, very long, typically a bunch of words strung together that are unrelated, things like that. And you protect your password, ideally with a good password manager rather than trying to remember them or just write them down. If you're careful to avoid vulnerabilities like shoulder surfing, so you're sitting in a cafe and you're logging in somewhere and somebody's able to watch as you type in your username and your password, and then they could log in as you. Or you don't reuse passwords at multiple sites. If one site gets compromised and somehow they manage to get your password on that site, you don't want them to be able to go and try that password on other sites using the same username, which is quite often just an email address. If you only sign in to sites with encrypted sessions, so it's HTTPS. Now, this is one place that I don't think the browsers have done us any favors. Google led the charge with this. It used to be that you'd always see HTTPS, and that meant secure, and you would also see a little lock, and it would be closed lock when you're on an encrypted session and an open lock when you were not. And Google led the charge to decide that this isn't nice to see that. So they took away the lock, so you don't see the lock. Then they took away HTTP and HTTPS, so that you don't see them. Now, in Chrome, you can actually click in the address bar and then hit the left arrow. You will actually see the HTTPS or HTTP, as the case may be. But it's a real mess from one browser to another how you actually see whether you're on an encrypted session or not. In some cases, you might have a little globe or something like that that you click on. It'll tell you if you're on a secure session or not. But yeah, it is really a mess to try to ensure that when you know when you're on an encrypted session versus unencrypted. And if you're also careful not to sign in on lookalike websites, so you accidentally mistype something or you sent a link that sends you to what you think is the Royal Bank, and it turns out that it's a lookalike website that is trying to fish your username and password on that. And be careful here, because just because you're on an encrypted session, that's not enough. That doesn't say who you're connected to. All it says is you have an encrypted session between you and the other end. I wrote an article for the newsletter on what does HTTPS really mean, and I talk more about that in that article. And if you make sure that the website is not hacked and user account information is being exfiltrated to an attacker who can try to reverse engineer the passwords. Now, even if it does get hacked, usually it shouldn't be a problem if you use a very strong password. Okay? So it's hard to compromise that, but there's a long list of caveats that you have to follow to make sure that it's hard to successfully compromise it. It might be easy to compromise if you don't follow all of those pieces of advice. Okay, so now let's get back into actually using two-factor authentication. So one of them would be a code sent to your phone as a text message. So there's a one-time setup at the website. So the website, when you're setting up two-factor authentication, it'll ask you for the phone number to use for texting those codes to. They will then send you a one-time code to test, to make sure you put in the right phone number and things like that. And then once you put in that code that gets sent to you as a text, then it says, okay, we're sending it to the right phone number, you're good to go. So from then on, when you sign in at the website, you first off have to enter in your username and your password as normal. But then the website will send you the time-limited one-time code as a text message. And it'll usually be good for 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. And so when you get that text message, you look at the text message. It'll have the one-time code. You enter that in at the website manually, and then it'll check to see that it's the same code that they actually sent you. And if somebody is trying to sign in as you, they still need your username and password, but they need that one-time code. And so that's the thing that two-factor authentication is strengthening, in that presumably they don't actually have your phone, so they can't get that text message sent to them. So it's quite hard to compromise that as long as you don't lose your phone. Okay, that'd be one thing. And your phone is protected with strong authentication. Doesn't help if your phone is not protected by strong authentication or no password to get into your phone, and then they can just, you know, steal your phone and they can get the code sent and they can get access to it. The other vulnerability with using text messaging as the two-factor authentication, this is one that's usually pointed out, and it's possible to do SIM swaps. And what that is where an attacker will contact your phone provider and say, oh, I'm Chris Taylor, I lost my phone, please transfer my phone number to this new SIM card on a new phone. And then after they get that, any text messages are going to be sent to their phone rather than your phone. Okay, so that's the vulnerability. It happens, it has happened, but if you can do anything to have your phone provider not transfer, you know, your phone number unless you have something extra, like I want to have it that I have to go into a kiosk and actually provide photo ID before you will transfer my phone number or something like that, or a secondary password that you have to give over the phone before you will allow a transfer of a phone number, something like that. If you can get that, that'll strengthen that particular vulnerability. So another one is to get a code sent to an email address. So again, it's one-time setup at the website. So they ask for the email address to use. They'll test it, make sure that it works, and then you're good to go. So then when you're signing in at the website that uses this, you go to, you get your username and password, and then you get that time-limited code sent to an email rather than text message. You enter that code in at the website, and then the website checks to make sure it's the same code that they actually sent to your email address. And so if somebody's trying to sign in as you, again, they still need your username and password, and they need that one-time code. This is very hard to compromise as long as you protect your email address really, really well. And that's important because if an attacker can compromise your email address and they can get into your email, then they can get access to any of those messages that get sent to your email address, get that one-time code, and then log in as you. Another thing that you should actually be a little bit careful of here, which I don't actually outline here, but if you think your email address has ever been compromised, you have any inkling at all, check to see whether there's an auto-forward on your email sending every email that comes in to another email address. Because an attacker might do that if they can get into your email address without changing the password. Then what they could do is set up an auto-forward, so anytime those one-time codes get sent, they will get sent to them as well. They can then try to log in on a website, they'll get the code, and they'll be able to log into that website as you. The next one is an authentication app that you install typically on a phone, but you can get authentication apps for desktops as well or laptops. So again, one-time setup on the website. Usually they'll display a QR code or a secret key. If it's a QR code, you just scan it with your phone, and it'll in the authentication app, and then it'll set up the link between you and the website. So the website and the authentication app itself are cryptographically linked together at that point, so they both know each other. When you sign in at the website, again, you enter your username and password. You get that limited one-time code generated by the authentication app as well as by the website. So both are independently generating this code based on an algorithm that is used on both ends that is the same. And so then you will get either a tap to approve in the authentication app, or you might get a push approval where it actually just it gives you a code that you have to put in. So if the one-time code matches the authentication app, then you get logged in, no problem. If someone's trying to sign in as you, they still need your username and password, and they need that one-time code. So it could be done by shoulder surfing if that is generating through that push approval. And the one-time code is only valid usually for about 60 seconds or so. It's quite short because it shouldn't need an awful lot of time to actually pass back and forth. And if the authentication app uses that tap to approve, then the one-time code is actually never displayed at all. And so that will defeat any shoulder surfing attempts. So authentication apps are pretty good. They're very, very hard to compromise.
Chris, yeah. Diane's asking that usually my username is my email address. Is that okay?
It's what you have to use. So often websites will insist on an email address because then they have somebody that they can contact in the event of any issues, either a password reset has to be done or whatever, they've already got your email address that way. There are some sites that will let you set up an independent username. I sort of prefer that because it's harder for an attacker to guess what my username is, whereas I've only got a couple of email addresses, and so they could take a stab at guessing at that. If a website allows me to use just an arbitrary username, I'll always go for it, and then I'll record it in my password manager. Okay, now we come down to what is the latest, greatest, and most confusing thing that is out there, and that's passkeys. So this is going to be what everybody is saying, the ultimate in authentication. So the one-time setup with the website, you set up an encryption key pair that goes between the website, which uses a public key, and then a private key stays on your device. And these two keys are mathematically linked so that only, you know, the public key can be used to validate the private key. The private key can be used to validate the public key. When you sign on at the website, the website sends a challenge to your device. And then you unlock your passkey application or interface or whatever it is on your particular device. And then so you have to have, you know, internal access to it to allow it to interact with the website. So your device signs the challenge using the private key, and then it sends that challenge back to the website, and then the website can use your public key, which it already has access to verify that it was actually signed by your private key. So it's very, very strong in terms of its authenticity, or, you know, the ability to verify authenticity. You actually never type in a password for a website. And so if a site is spoofing a legitimate site, it's going to fail because it does not have all of the match between the public key and the private key that was set up the first time. Very, very hard to compromise passkeys. Bingo card. So again, I mentioned this only because the Canada Revenue Agency allows it. I think it's not a bad thing. One time set up on the website, it'll actually generate a new bingo card for you once you're signed in. And when you sign in to the website, you're challenged to input some two-letter codes. So it might be, you know, give me the two-letter codes at row 5, column C, followed by row 1, column F, followed by row 3, column A, for example. And then the website will verify that your answer matches their copy of the bingo card. They have an exact copy of that. So if somebody's trying to sign in as you, they still need your username and password, and they need your bingo card. So it's very hard to compromise as long as you keep your bingo card secure. So a good place to store it might be a notes field in your password manager. And we all know that the password manager is something you want to guard really, really carefully with a very, very long, secure password. So the bottom line, I think, is that absolutely any form of two-factor authentication is going to be way stronger than not having two-factor authentication at all. So even those that have vulnerabilities into them, the vulnerabilities are such that you're still going to be way better off having it. So think about how your authentication is most likely going to be compromised by an attacker and look to see which two-factor authentication will protect against that. And that would be the ideal one for you. Now, having said that, in order of strength, probably, okay, this is my thoughts on it, things that can help with some of the careless behaviors, so password reuse, weak passwords, accidental password disclosure, shoulder surfing, things like that, passkeys and authentication apps are the best ways to guard against those careless behaviors. Less helpful would be text messages to a phone, an email message, or bingo card, but they're still way, way better than not having two-factor authentication at all. And I asked Perplexity to rank the relative strengths, and so I said, create a graph showing relative strength, various forms of authentication including, and I listed all the ones that I've been talking about, and this is the way that it came up rating things. And, whoops, sorry, I thought I had a highlight on there. So you can see that FIDO security key is the absolute strongest, passkeys just down tiny from that, and then it goes all the way down to one as username and password only. So look to that as being sort of a general guide in terms of relative strength of them. But again, I think in actual fact, it goes from one email OTP and on down should probably start at about 5 and then go up to 15 or something like that. Like going from a username and a password to something else is going to be a bigger jump than just double, I believe. Okay, standalone two-factor authentication. A lot of what we've been talking about requires that you have access to, a phone with data coverage or text messaging capability, or it requires access to your email address in order to be able to get that second factor authentication. So some second factors don't actually require internet or phone access. So a list of one-time codes, like the bingo cards, or Google will actually offer a list of 10 one-time codes that you can use in order, one at a time, and they can only be used one at a time, one after the other, and only for one time each. And so if you can't get in using your password, if you have these one-time codes, you can go to wherever you got them listed, maybe your notes field in the password manager, and then put it in, and it'll allow you to get into your email and then set your password to something that works for you. And same with the bingo card. Doesn't actually require internet access. It's just asking for values on your bingo card, which could be printed out or just ideally a notes field in your password manager. Authentication apps might require internet access. So internet is not required if you manually enter a code shown in the authentication app into the website. So it generates that code independently, the website and your authentication app. They don't have to be talking to each other at that point in time. So make sure your device has a clock set correctly, because that if your device has got the wrong time set, authentication apps can actually fail. And this can avoid problems when you're out of country and you don't have roaming, or you don't have a SIM card that is matching the SIM card you use at home. So you can't get text messages to it or things like that. So it's potential that authentication apps that don't require internet access would be a good thing for you. Internet is still going to be required for any app authentication app that has the tap to approve. And if you have that, it does require the authentication application to talk in real time to the back end. So my personal preference, have multiple two-factor authentications for any one service. So have backups in case one fails for any reason at all. So say you have a code getting sent to your email address, and then for some reason you get locked out of your email. How do you get in? You may be locked out. If you have a different method for two-factor authentication for that same service, then you can try a backup one. And most of the sites that allow you two-factor authentication will allow you to set up two or more two-factor authentications. So personally, I use a one-time code sent to an email address, and that's my main use. I can usually get access to email on any of the devices, even devices that I don't own. I can log into my email and get access to that. Make sure that you do use strong passwords on that email address. So any email address you use as the second factor, make sure that an attacker is not going to be able to compromise that by using a very, very strong password on it. On the phone, for use for two-factor authentication, make sure that you have a strong password protecting your phone. If you have a password manager that are used for one-time codes like Google will allow you to use, or bingo cards, make sure your password manager has very strong. And make sure your password manager is always available to you. When you're out of country, or if you're out of service area on your phone, if you have a copy of your password manager on your phone with a local copy of the database, then you can get access to that. So one thing, make sure you're not caught in circular hell. So if you use email A is protected by two-factor authentication using email B, and email B is protected by two-factor authentication using email A, well, you'd be sort of locked out. You're not going to be able to get into either of those accounts. So caution, will your second factor authentication, second factor always be available? So passkeys and authentication apps are typically tied to a single device. Now, there are exceptions to that, but I don't want to get into that, and I have not actually used any of those means to try to have passkeys or authentication apps that roam with your devices. So you can use it on a desktop as well as using it on a phone or things like that. So what if you lose your phone or you just don't happen to have it with you? So that'll be a problem if you're using text to the phone or an authentication app that's installed on that particular device. What if you lose access to your email? My brother, he lost access to his main email, and he didn't really care because it was just, who cares? I'll get rid of, you know, all the email that was stored there. Doesn't matter to me anymore at all. And that was fine until such time he tried to log into a service that sent a code to that email address, and he was no longer able to get the code. And so now he's locked out of that other account as well. So that can be a problem. What if you're traveling abroad? You know, maybe you don't have roaming. Maybe you have a local SIM card to save you money so that you're not doing roaming charges all the time. Well, that's a different phone number. So any authentication or one-time codes that are sent to your phone as a text message are not going to make it. What if you don't have access to your bingo card or those 10 one-time codes that Google let you set up? Can you set up passkeys or authentication apps on multiple devices? Some websites might allow you to do that. Some of them you won't. So mitigations, again, I think set up multiple second factors. And another option is to turn off the second factor if you can, when necessary. So if you're traveling abroad, you can just decide, okay, maybe I can turn off second factor authentication, two-factor authentication, while I'm out of country, and then I'll just rely on my username and password. Again, strong password. So setting up multiple two-factor authentications does have multiple risks. So each of the two-factor authentications could be available for an attacker to actually try. So you have to protect every method used for two-factor authentication to the best of your ability. My personal opinion, multiple two-factor authentications to avoid being locked out of your accounts. Okay, to me, that outweighs the risk of having a single two-factor authentication. So exceptions to that would be any account where you can actually get a reset done. So I'm not going to be able to get, if I screw up my Google account, there's no way that I'm going to be able to talk to Google and say, oh, it's really me. Can you please unlock my account? I only had username and password, and I forgot my password. Can you reset it for me? Or, you know, my second factor of authentication is a phone that I no longer have. So can you please reset it? I'm not going to be able to do that with Google. But I can with my bank. I know that if worst case scenario, I can walk down to a branch and I can give them ID and prove I am who I say I am, and they can get things fixed for me. So, you know, I think that it's really, really critical to think about things in that sort of level of detail. Document all uses of two-factor authentications in your password manager so that you know where you used it. So you know that when you decide to give up an email address, for example, you can go in and say, did I use that as a second factor of authentication anywhere, and reset it to something new before you give up that email address. You have to do your own risk assessment. Okay? So think about all of the slides that I've put up there already, and think about, you know, what are the risks, and, you know, you have to decide what makes the most sense to you. Now, before we go on to Alan's portion of the presentation, Alan, is there anything in the chat that we should deal with?
Yes, Darlene's asking, where do you look in your email for auto-forwarding settings?
It depends on the email that you have. In Google, you would go to settings, and then let me just quickly check to see exactly where you go. Mail. Whoops.
In the chat, she says she already found it, Chris.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's usually pretty easy to find. And it's good for everybody to actually check periodically to make sure that something hasn't happened, that all your email is being forwarded to an attacker. So now, Alan, didn't you have slides on some other passkey information?
Yeah, but that's going to be next week, Chris.
Oh, okay. Yeah, actually, we ran right into 8:30 here. So next week, Alan will have some other information about using passkeys. One thing I will say to it is that I think passkeys are simple when they work, but they can be really, really complex to get set up, and a lot of cautions about actually using it, mostly dealing with the idea of it being a single device where your passkey is actually generated and usable. And there are some other things that I ran across recently on it that I find passkeys are really problematic. I really recommend that if people want to start playing with passkeys, start with accounts where you can get a reset done if necessary. I ran into an issue with Canada Life, so insurance for public service, and I know that I can get a reset done if I need to by calling them up on the phone and getting whatever is necessary to get back into my account. I also don't need access, you know, today, tomorrow, the next day, and things like that to it. So I can play around with things like passkeys on that, find out if there are any issues on something that I can get fixed by somebody else. Try those first. Don't try them on your Google account. Don't try them on your Microsoft account as the first go.
So Dan says my iPhone uses face recognition. Can that be used as a second factor?
Usually, yes. But again, it depends on the website you're trying to authenticate to, whether it will allow you to choose that or not. So you just have to check any website that allows two-factor authentication. They will give you a list of those that it can support. And so it may support that or may not. You just have to check with the website.
Okay, so Steve's raised his hand. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, if you've got the Microsoft Authenticator on your PC and on your phone, can you use either one?
Yeah. I don't know. I suspect not by default. The Authenticator app will be tied to one Authenticator app. It may be possible on any given website to set up two second-factor authentication, both of which are Authenticator apps, one on your phone and one on your desktop. And then you'd be able to choose which one when you're logging on that website. But that's something that you have to
try. That was what I wanted to do last night, and it had multiple two-factor authentication things. But the other ones that it had were the Authenticator app on your phone or another number code, the SMS thing,
yeah,
on your phone. So I first started off with the one for the SMS, and then it says, what's your phone number? So I entered that in and says, oh, you can't use that because it's already been used for the first one. Huh? You have to have two cell phones, one to authenticate the other one, and then you need, and then the Microsoft Authenticator, if it only works on the phone, well, there's not much point in having multiple authentications for the same device, is there?
Exactly, exactly.
In the chat, Tristan says, if you use a passkey, always set them up on at least two devices for each service.
If you can.
He says, an authenticator like NT-Auth can be synchronized between a phone and a PC.
Now, that, again, is a specific implementation that allows you to do that authenticator app. And I've seen passkeys as well, which can actually be portable. If you use certain password managers, you can actually embed the passkey implementation in the password manager, and the password manager is portable. And in some cases, that can work. Not all cases. And that's where a lot of this two-factor authentication starts falling down. It's the idea like Steve ran into where he can't set up a text message and an authenticator on the same phone. Well, that's the implementation that was forced upon you by that particular website. There's no, you know, reason technically why that shouldn't be possible. It's the implementation at that website that imposed that restriction. So the whole thing of two-factor authentication is really a mess.
I think all authenticators work alike.
Yes.
And they create some kind of hash code based on your email and the website.
You can transfer the
contents to another phone or another device.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have done that between phones when I upgraded.
Yeah, they do work similarly. There are some differences in authenticator apps. The main one is whether it has tap to approve or whether it's the notification where it'll actually send you the code. There is tap to approve or done just through a code. But that's the particular implementation of the – that requires a correct negotiation between the website and the authenticator app as well, but it will usually just choose the one that works with it. So that's usually not an issue. So, yes, I have heard that authenticators are – portable in that sense, that you can actually change your or copy your authentication app data from one device to another. I've never actually tried to do it myself, but apparently it can be done. How it's done by each authentication app could be different. I don't know. But all authenticator apps should be able to function. So I first off started with I think I've got three authenticator apps on my phone before I really understood about this at all. And it turns out that as a general rule, you know, you only need one authenticator app, and you can use any of the ones that are out there, whether it's a Microsoft Authenticator, Google Authenticator, or whatever.
Okay. I think we've got lots of discussion about 2FA. I was going to say that the coverage was there in terms of questions and shares and all the other things that we normally do, but we do have a holdover at least on two-factor authentication and passkeys in particular. Now, I might note that the information that I have on passkeys is very generic. I've never used passkeys myself, so if anybody has used passkeys and has information on them, you want to put together a share on that, we'd really appreciate it. If you have more information on using authenticators in multiple situations, that would be also useful. So anything you have along those lines would be good for next week. Now, we have to call up the idea generator because we need some information. And if you recall, we were deal with questions relating to hardware and software. We have shares on any computer-related topics of interest. Can be details of a program that you really find useful. And we have our YouTube tech and video links, basic computer information, recommended Canadian links, we call them Looney links, and again, technical type computer-related websites, smartphone or tablet applications that you find useful, and tweaks to operating systems, and that would include Windows Lurks and Android. So you've got lots of different topics there that you can ask questions about, provide information as in the form of shares, and we'd love to hear from you about that. I mentioned earlier that next week is going to be the start of our monthly meeting series, so September the 9th is going to be Chris talking about artificial intelligence. And you'll note that this is a bonus presentation. It's going to be a two-hour presentation. So instead of being 7:30 to 9, it's going to be 7:30 start and running to 9:30 to give Chris and all his chatbots time to talk to each other, I guess. Anyway, that's going to be next week, September the 9th. And on September the 10th, if anybody didn't see my earlier presentation about Windows 10 end of life, and you're interested in the ESU program still, or if you're interested in what's going to happen when Windows 10 really does hit end of life, which is a moving target right now, I'm going to be talking about it to the Durham group on Thursday, September 10th. And that's the link for the Zoom presentation. They'll be happy to see you there if you want to catch up on Windows 10 end of life.
Yes, we will. Very happy. Anybody's welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. And so our next Q&A is going to be in 2 weeks. You've got lots of time to think about those questions and put those shares together. So September the 16th will be our next Q&A session. But we'll see you all next week for Chris's AI presentation on September the 9th. So great questions, great discussion tonight. Thanks very much. Love to hear more about all of the above from you. And we'll see you next week at Chris's presentation.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.